Hey friends, just before we start this episode, a quick note that I recorded this interview while I was on the road traveling. Some kind people let me use their podcast studio, and for some odd reason, the audio quality is not great, but the interview is great. So we're keeping the interview. I'm really excited for you to hear it, and apologies that my audio is a bit on the rough side. Thanks.
You're listening to Managing Leadership Anxiety, Yours and Theirs, a podcast offered in partnership with Missio Alliance. Each episode, we discuss internal and relational pressures, how they block effective leadership, and how we can move through them to a greater health. And now your host, Steve Cutts.
Oh, friends, what a treat for you guys. I am here with the single most ravishing piece of masculine flesh on planet Earth, Nick Kane.
What a cross I bear with that title.
Nick Kane, and many of you may not know Nick. You may be more familiar with his wife, Christine Kane. Nick, how many men have introduced you using that phrase?
Not a single one. I've had, when I have been introduced with that phrase, I've had many men stand up beside me because they thought Chris was talking about them. But
yeah,
no man.
I can appreciate
the single most busy.
Yes, I can appreciate the confusion, because now that I'm in my 50s and my wife is still in her 40s, what she calls the mid-40s, even though she's actually upper 40s, she's now making me moisturize my face, Nick, and people are mistaking me for a supermodel everywhere I go. it's out of control. But Nick, you're not with me alone. You are joined by your absolute force of nature wife, Christine Kane. Christine, welcome to the show as well.
Steve, it's my honor to be here. I'm a bit scared. I'm on this with two Aussie blokes, and girls, as you can tell, they've already hijacked the conversation, and this promises to be an awesome conversation.
You know, obviously, Chris, you're the more public facing of the Kane couple. Like, you're this phenomenal preacher, one of the most powerful preachers I know. I also just wanted to mention to folks that your brand new book, Don't Look Back, is actually available for pre-release right now. I'll put a link in the show notes, but probably by the time this episode comes out, it's going to be within days of release. Yeah. So I did want to have you talking about the book and why you wrote it, but also I wanted you guys both on the show together, because the way you minister together is inspiring to me, and I think it just honestly moves me to tears, the work that you do and what you have built with A21, which I've gotten the incredible privilege of getting an up-close personal look at, is just mind-blowing. So lots to talk about, not to mention the gauntlet of anxiety questions. But Chris, tell us about this latest book. What was the driving impetus to write it?
I will. And firstly, Steve, Nick and I love you so much, and we're so grateful. Everyone's going to find out, you know, you have done so much work with our, well, me personally, and with our team as well, which has been so, we're just so, so grateful for you. And we are believing God that Lisa does exist. So definitely for you. And I live by faith. I walk by faith and not by sight that Lisa does exist.
As a real human.
There is. You know, I'll give you the reason I wrote, I really feel Don't Look Back is for this moment. You know, there's no doubt people are stuck everywhere. You know, for A21, we have 19 offices in 15 countries. And so Nick and I are constantly doing laps of the globe, talking to people everywhere and the church all around the world. And there's nowhere, there's not a country in the world that I go to where people are not stuck in some ways. And even you hear the language, like, if I say, how are you, or how is church even, or something like that, people will literally go, well, before the pandemic. Now, Steve, we're recording this in 2023. So they're like, you know, before. So it used to be that we used to have BCAD, and that stood for, you know, before Christ, Anno Domini. Now it's BC, before COVID. And I'm going, okay, there is something happening. Like, it's like people have literally almost are stuck in a time. And the amount of times I've heard the phrase, if we could just go back to normal, if we could just go back, if things could just go back to normal, and the crazier the world gets, the more people want it. Well, in the midst of that, I had been reading Luke 17, and Jesus is doing his discourse on the end times, you know, talking about the kingdom's here but not yet fully realized. And in the middle of talking about Noah, the flood, Sodom and Gomorrah burning, you know, I mean, everything, all the stuff that I don't understand. Everyone's on rabbit trails in Facebook looking for the end times. I don't get any of that. But Jesus just drops in these three little words. He's like, remember Lot's wife in Luke 17:32. And so, Steve, you know, I've done so much women's ministry in my life, and I have 35 years of women's conferences. I have never heard a message on Lot's wife, heard a lot of women in the Bible. And, of course, there's about 170 women that have in some way, shape or form been alluded to in Scripture. And yet there's only one that Jesus tells us to remember. There's only one out of all of those women. And I've taught so many messages on Deborah and Ruth and Mary. And, you know, you think of them all throughout history, Miriam. And, you know, I mean, why would Jesus, in the midst of a discourse about the end times, say, remember Lot's wife, like just throw it in there? Well, he didn't just throw it in there, but he would tell us to do that. And, of course, I'm thinking if I was Eve, I would be ticked off because I'm like, I was first. And I was first, and I've been blamed for all the problems of humanity ever since. So why not remember me? Or, you know, Sarah, why not remember me? Like I birthed a kid without an epidural at 90. Or, you know, I mean, we could go through all the list. And so I'm like, okay, why her? So I go back to Genesis 19, where there's the mention of Lot's wife. And, of course, the thing that we all know, which is the only thing that we know about this woman that appears on the pages of Scripture, just like quickly enough to disappear, is that, you know, when everything was burning down in Sodom and Gomorrah, that the angel of the Lord said, don't look back. And then, of course, in Genesis 19, it says, but Lot's wife behind him looked back and turned into a pillar of salt. And to cut it all really short, basically, here is someone that was being rescued of everything that was burning down, life as we know it. And then that looking back, when she looked back, the inference there is that she looked back with a longing to go back. There was, of course she would. Like, why wouldn't she? There's no shade here because her life was there. Her extended family was there. Her home, everything was there. Life as she knew it was there. Very abruptly, she was disrupted, almost in a traumatic way. You're coming out of everything that's burning and you're moving forward. A lot of us feel that same way over the last few years. It's been a traumatic disruption, life as we know it in many ways, or dreams as we've known them, or relationships as we've known them, or ministries or businesses, I mean, insert whatever. She was told, don't look back. So she looked back and turned into a pillar of salt. So she effectively became calcified and stuck in a moment that she should have only been passing through. And say us as new, I'm thinking, why would Jesus say, remember Lot's wife? And I'm thinking in the context of our world, both in the church world and the external world, it seems like life as we know it is burning to the ground. It's like just changing. It's done. And our tendency is to want to look back either at past successes or past methods or failures or pain or heartache or whatever it might be. And yet we can become calcified. Instead of being the salt of the world into the future, we're becoming calcified and stuck in a present that's looking back to the past. And so I thought it is crucial that we learn, when I say don't look back, I'm not talking about looking back to deal with pain so that we can heal to move forward. I'm talking back that longing to want to go back, whatever that might be. That could be in successes or pain. Get stuck in a moment of pain or hurt or anger. And, you know, what my own life, my own story, but then, of course, working with the victims and survivors of human trafficking around the world, I've seen the key principles of this message at work. I mean, how do you take a victim that has been repeatedly raped 20 or 30 times a day for a number of years? And how do you begin a healing journey and a restoration process of looking forward and not getting stuck in the past? Well, you know, in the day and the era in which we live, where there has been a good focus on acknowledging the past and acknowledging pain and learning to reveal things so that God can heal them, there is a very fine line between acknowledging to deal and acknowledging to stay stuck and gain your identity from what happened to you or from where you've been or from what you've accomplished. And so I thought it was a very urgent hour to go, okay, three little words, most people can remember that, remember Lot's wife. And if I can at least get that into people's thinking, you can discern where do I not need to look back. Even when the Lord said to, you know, Joshua, I want you to get remembrance stones. They picked up remembrance stones to remember the faithfulness of God, not to get stuck in the wilderness and their past And I think, you know, that kind of dichotomy is what we're just living in a moment where there is so much noise and language around the past, and there's a good side of that, but there's also a danger that you can be calcified and stuck rather than moving forward into the fullness of what God has.
Yeah, and I think the other thing, as I'm listening to you there, Chris, that I really appreciate is I think there is a lot of people like wishing for what was, and there's just also so much ambiguity and unknown still, even in 2023, a lot of people kind of in a COVID hangover, I think. And what's also true is there's unbelievable, powerful ministry going on. I normally record these interviews in my home studio, and I'm on the road right now, and there's a church that I'm working with just in the Midwest that are very kindly letting me use their podcast studio. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, here is another church that most people have not heard of unless you live here. And they've got an extensive food pantry. They are doing incredible, innovative work among the developmentally disabled. Like the level of ministry and the things that they're doing. And here we have the body of Christ and the kingdom of God flourishing and thriving and expanding. And that's kind of where I want to take our chat. And Nick, see if you would maybe help us out here. You guys have an expression of the kingdom of God that is so particular, where you are helping people get rescued out of sex slavery. Nick, I wonder if you would tell us, what does A21 do?
So A21's goal is to abolish human trafficking in the 21st century. So that means we want to reach vulnerable people, people who are vulnerable to being trafficked, with information so that they can avoid being trafficked, or if they get into a situation where they're experiencing trafficking, they have ways to get out. We want to rescue victims, and we run the National Anti-Human Trafficking Hotline in multiple countries, and work with law enforcement in all 15 of the countries that we're working in, to be able to identify, isolate, and help facilitate the rescue of victims of human trafficking. And then we want to restore the survivors. We want to see people who have come through that experience end up with their life being better than it would have been had that never happened to them. So really see a process of restoration, see them restored emotionally, physically, spiritually, and economically, so that they end up in a place which is better than they could have ever imagined, as well as putting the people who have caused the problem, the traffickers, in jail. And we're passionate about that, because every time we put a trafficker in jail, it's 1,000 girls that we may not have to rescue. So we work across the gambit and have teams of people spread out across 19 cities in 15 countries. And they're just some of the smartest, most capable, hardworking, dedicated, innovative people that I've ever had the good pleasure to know.
Yeah, I can echo that, having worked with some of your key leaders and then also just some of your global team, and just getting to even learn some of the real particulars, like how some of your global team on the field know how to walk into just an everyday shelter and help identify somebody who may be currently or has been trafficked, just that unique skill, and then how they work with law enforcement to get them out. And then you guys have an extensive recovery and rehab and restoration program. We're talking psychologists and the whole deal. Christine, if I'm remembering right, am I right that this started with you in Thessaloniki, Greece?
Yeah, standing in a baggage claim when I saw the posters of missing women and children. And really, that was the genesis of the entire. I didn't know, Steve. We're 15 years old now, A21. So let's say it was about 18 months before we actually started. So, you know, 16, 17 years ago, I did not even know this issue existed on the earth today. So that's how recent it is that even I've understood the issue.
Yeah. Okay. And then another important question, as much as we're talking about a very serious and grave topic, the question should also be asked, if you weren't in Greece, would you still have heard from the Lord? Do you have to be in Greece, Chris, to listen to the Lord?
No, you have to know. Everyone wants to be Greek. My big fat Greek wedding tree is coming.
Yeah. Okay, so this is what I want to dig into with you guys for a little bit, because, Chris, I think most people who know your preaching and love your preaching would say, you know, Christian Cain's one of the most inspiring, motivational preachers. You sit under a Christian Cain sermon, and you're going to come away feeling like, man, I can do it. God can do it through me. But there are some people who preach the way you do that actually haven't really built anything, right? Like, they're really good at inspiring you, but you guys have actually built something of phenomenal substance that's making a massive impact. What were the first steps that the two of you took to get A21 going and actually starting to make a difference? How did you begin?
I came home and said, Nick, I feel like we're supposed to do this. And then now, Steve, you are letting the secret out to the world. And now I'm going to let Nick talk, because that is how this thing exists. Yeah.
Yeah. So one of my mantras is prescription without diagnosis is malpractice. So we had heard about human trafficking, but we didn't know very much. So the first thing we did was try to figure out, okay, what is the problem, and help identify the problem, and then identify a strategy to attack the problem. And that involved us asking lots of questions, and digging into areas that we didn't know anything about. We were happily preaching, working with churches, and had never come across human trafficking until we sort of were at that baggage claim and saw pictures of missing kids. So then it was a case of understand the problem, develop a strategy, and then build a team to attack the problem. And we found some fantastic people. I think you've got to meet Phil and some of the others. And we then just launched at it, and we kept on having a go. We kept on trying new things, and we'd try something and it didn't work, or we'd try something and it worked a little bit, so we'd tweak it, and we kept on turning up. The early days of A21 were miraculous in that we did see victims rescued. We managed to take over a shelter that had been being run by a government agency that hadn't had anybody in it for 3 years, and within weeks we had victims in the shelter, which was great because we'd seen somebody rescued and we'd motivated the police to engage in the fight against human trafficking. But that created the next problem, and you can never be mad at God for the problem that you have today when it's the answer to the prayer that you prayed yesterday, which is, okay, we have we now have survivors to care for. What the heck do we do with them? So we had to develop programs to walk them through the process of restoration and try to deal with the psychological and the trauma issues that they had, as well as negotiating the court scenarios and police interactions, and how do we get the trafficker convicted? How do we put this girl who's been through horrific things, was raped 40 times a day for 2 years? How do you start to approach the trauma that is in her? And so we, again, sort of we recruited new people onto the team. Many of them were volunteers. Many of them were relationships who sewed into the team to help us. And gradually we've developed all the programs that we have today. And so today we have sort of 150 programs. We have clinical psychologists, and we have social workers and counsellors and all that sort of stuff on the team. But in the beginning it was, okay, let's deal with this problem. And when that we solved that problem, it always created another problem. So you fix those problems and then get all the things working together. So it's been a process of experimentation, development, not being afraid to fail, and keep on having a go, step up, and every time there's a challenge, figure out a solution. And it's it is the result of a phenomenal team of people. Chris and I are blessed that we lead with a team, so we don't actually have to solve the problems, because most of the problems that need solving, we don't have the solutions to. But we have phenomenal people on our team who do have the solutions to those problems, and we try and empower them. I try and always get the solution, which is as close to the problem as possible. So whoever's closest to the problem, in my opinion, generally has got a better idea of how to fix it than me 10,000 miles away and not dealing in that situation. So we try and recruit great people, equip them and keep out of their way and let them do what they're great at. So that's a short answer.
I love that. So, you know, Dr. Stephen Sample, right in your backyard, he used to be the president of USC. He wrote this fantastic book called The Contrarian's Guide to Leadership. And a lot of what you just said, Nick, is what he teaches. He says, what you do is hire the best people you can, and then you go work for them. You know, you having hired them, you're like, what do you need? What do you need? And you just keep deploying them, and just amazing. Okay, so Chris, you're at Thessaloniki. You see the poster. You know, God really speaks to you and says, hey, want you to do something, which makes perfect sense because you're a traveling evangelist and you're married to a banker. So, of course, you guys are the right ones to tackle the very complex multivalent problem of trafficking. But, Chris, I'm interested in when did you first know, hey, this is going to – we're doing this. Like, what was the moment for you where, like, I'm not just talking about it. There's actually traction here. We're actually getting something done.
There were a couple of major things, because I think initially I didn't think we would be doing something. I thought I might become a spokesperson.
Right.
Yeah, I was getting ready to teach the parable of the Good Samaritan. And honestly, as I'm preparing, I'm in that text and I have this sense in my heart, you know, Christine, I felt like the Lord through his word said to me in my heart, you know, Christine, you think you're the Samaritan in this text, don't you? And which I'm thinking, yes, because I was already traveling the world and I had two babies. I'm 40 years old and like Australia is far from everywhere. You know, if you're going to be an evangelist from Australia to the rest of the world at the time, it's far. So I'm like, and hitching a couple of kids with you for that trip is not easy. So I'm thinking, this is awesome. I'm about to get a gold star. And I felt the Lord say, no, Christine, you're more like the Levite and the priest in this story than you are the Samaritan. Because when I saw those posters and my heart was so moved, it was like I felt the Lord say, like, you thought that these people are an interruption to your ministry rather than the object of it. It was like the Levite and the priest, they saw the man on the side of the road as an interruption to their ministry rather than the object of it. Whereas the Levite, the priest, and the Good Samaritan, all of them were busy people on their way to somewhere else, but only one crossed the street and got involved. And I felt the Lord say to me, Chris, you've confused, sympathy and compassion, because compassion is what caused the Good Samaritan to cross the street. But that compassion meant that he gave of his own time, his own talent, and his own treasure and got involved with his own life into the life of this. Whereas we think because we watch a sad video about something and cry that we're moved with compassion, but that's just like sympathy or maybe at best empathy, maybe. So it was like, well, Christina, you're just going to be sympathetic or are you going to be truly compassionate? Because if it's truly compassionate, you have to cross the street and disrupt your entire ministry. We were traveling 300 days a year. We were all over the world helping, you know, plant churches and helping be involved in different forms of mission and evangelism. And then it was as I began to speak about it, I just remember what really happened once was I spoke about it at a women's conference and the Lord moved so powerfully. I didn't even know what was happening that then the pastor's wife got up and said, I've never done this in the history of the church. The church was about 20 years old, a very large church, and said, but I feel prompted right now. We have to receive an offering for this work. At that point, there was no work. And then I started freaking out because, like, it's like happening despite me. And I remember they received an offering and for A21. And I said to, you know, they were sending it, they were wiring it back to the ministry in Australia. And I'm calling Nick. I was bawling my eyes out. I'm going, God must want us to do this because, and I said, oh my gosh, I don't know. I felt so inadequate. There is not one moment in those early days where I could say to you, oh, I knew God called me and I was God's woman of hour for the power. There is no way. I was like, I felt convicted through the word that I was being more like the Levite and the priest than the Samaritan, despite all the work that we were doing. And then that conference that was so sobering and then very holy, and that I watched all of these people give to this work, and I thought, Lord, you're leading. It was, and then one, and then the third thing. So this might freak all of your people out. Okay, I know, you know, Steve and I come from different backgrounds, but so I already have these, you know, moments. And then I went back to Australia, and one night, and this is only, so people don't have to freak out, this has only ever happened to me a couple of times in my entire life, and I'm 57 years old. But
you don't have to apologize for hearing from the Lord and sharing it with the
Lord. It's just the way that might be manifested. But, and this is only the two, maybe three times in my entire life something like this has happened. But I, out of my sleep, woke up, Nick's lying there, you know, I'm sweating like literally, like the only time I sweated like that was when I was going through menopause. Because you're you, Steve, I can say that. That is the only time.
Well, and in Australia, we would say you were glowing like a pig.
That's it, mate. I was glowing like a pig 100%. And but what happened is in my sleep, I could hear the screams of women and children, and I woke up literally drenched, screaming out loud, "We're coming to get you. We're coming to get you." And it was like between the parable of the Good Samaritan, this unbelievable supernatural moment in a church and people giving to the work, and then waking up out of my sleep, it was like we're meant to do something. And that's when I knew. And, you know, it was only after all of that that I began to piece together the history of my own past and how I was only one degree of separation from so many of these women and children we were separating. I mean, had I not been born in Australia and left in a hospital there where there is a rule of law and a proper adoption system, I could be one of the kids that I'm rescuing. And my biological mother, who, you know, I know nothing about her other than she, the supposed father was a 55-year-old married man and she was a 23-year-old single woman. I mean, it's like he's a case of, like, you know, an older man that could have been her father. She's an immigrant in Australia, no family, who knows? But it's, it, you look at it and go, wow, look at my family of origin, look at the adoption, look at, and it all comes together that here I am today by the grace of God, you know, reaching those that are vulnerable, rescuing those that are enslaved, and restoring the survivors of that, and thinking there is about one degree of separation between me and them.
That raises a question for me that I would love to hear from both of you on. When you are a kingdom worker doing, really what you guys are doing is working directly in the realm of evil, mm-hmm. right? And when people's lives are at stake and the need is overwhelming, how do you know, how do you take a break? What do you do for your own pleasure and refreshment, right? Like, I'm not wording the question well, Nick, I'll throw it to you first, but it seems to me that the more intense the work, the more you have to make sure that you are well, but at the same time, it must be so hard to turn off that loop that says, look, if I just give one more hour, then another kid can be saved kind of idea. How do you mitigate that, Nick? And then I'd love to ask you that, Chris.
I love being outside. So I got suckered by another Australian into a mountain bike race a few years ago. And when I realized that what I'd got myself into, I started to mountain bike quite a bit. And it's become my refuge. So I get out. It's hard work because we do a lot of climbing, hill climbs and all that sort of stuff. And if you're not absolutely focused on what you're doing, then the potential for injury is quite high. And so that means that I can't focus on anything else. And it's great physical exercise, and it completely changes my mental state. And it's worked well enough for me that if I'm a bit grumpy, then Chris or the girls will look at me and say, Dad, when was the last time you went for a ride? We think it's time that you go and get on a bike. And it does, it literally changes my mental state. But as you said, it changes, it makes me focus on something other than all of the things that we're doing. So that you just completely disconnect for an hour or two, and then you come back to it, and okay, you actually tend to have more, I tend to have more clarity when I come back having been disconnected for a little while.
Great. Yeah. How about you, Chris?
I think I'm the same in terms of outdoors. You know, I do a lot of hiking and love to climb, well, hike mountains, not climb them, but hike mountains. And we really intentionally, it's not just Nick and I, but to be honest, the people we care most about are our frontline workers. I mean, you know, we live, although we travel a lot, we live amongst beauty and get to have great encouragement and fellowship with people. You know, I can see you if I need to, you're right there, like, you know, we're in the same country, but it's our workers in Cambodia, South Africa, Thailand, and they're surrounded by darkness. So not just the darkness of the work, you know, particularly sex, helping to rescue victim out of sex trafficking or forced labor trafficking, but there's a spiritual oppression generally in just the environment that they're in, and there's the cultural issues. So I am very mindful, and I think Nick and I lead by example in that area with great intentionality, because I want our team to know that we truly want them to be well. So even in their own context, a lot of our team have taken up hiking or biking. I've seen it. I've seen it over the last few years. And we're very intentional with our country directors to ensure that both them and their teams, that there's not this this sort of treadmill. I think we're realistic to know, you know, that our shoulders are not broad enough to bear the weight of the world. Jesus did that at Calvary. I don't need to do that. And if he could live in the tension of the already and not yet, we've got to learn to live in the tension. So the same spirit that raised Jesus from the dead lives in me. And that same spirit enabled Jesus to live. I mean, even when I talk about my book, I did that text out of Luke 17 where he's talking about the kingdom realized in him, but not yet fully realized. Well, he lived in that tension here on earth and somehow was able to navigate that in his humanity as well as his divinity. So number one, we don't even come close to him. And I'm figuring if he could navigate it, then we have to be able to. There are also certain things for me personally, I just can't read, like some of the reports, especially from some of our Asian countries and very young children. They can send me into a tailspin. That's when I can get into real areas of unhealth and feel the weight of the world and feel like we're doing nothing. And then I can get angry with everybody in the body of Christ and think everybody should be doing this. And why is it, you know, that's when I can really lose perspective. Because I don't think we're meant to go down that rabbit hole. I have to constantly be giving it to the Lord. That's where the cross makes more sense to me than anything, because I don't know, where else do you put this evil and this suffering? I don't know what to do with it. My synapses can't cope with it. My physiology can't, and Nick's can't, because Nick wants to go and take them all out. You know, he wants to, and I don't know what to do. I'm like, what do the mothers do with this? What do the children do? Like so I have to have a degree of separation, but I couldn't do it. I mean, there'd be a lot of cognitive dissonance if there was no cross. So it's the cross that enables me to not have, to not go, I'm sort of like two separate human beings. I'm one person. So I understand the reality, but I don't have to go into that black hole of the pain and the evil and the suffering. I can bring that to the cross where Jesus died for it. And one day I know it's been redeemed, but all things will be made new. For me, that kind of theology is not optional. It's the only way I could survive, that there will be one day a new heaven and a new earth, that Jesus is coming back. I guess for me, that's why, I don't know what it might look like, but do I believe that there is a hell, whatever? Yes. And seeing the evil that I see in human trafficking, I'd want there to be one, you know, like I always think the people that kind of think that, I don't know what that might look like. I'm not going into that detail, but what I am saying is for the people that think there isn't one. I'm like, you don't do the work that I do. Because if you were doing this work, you'd be hoping that there was one.
It's so interesting you mentioned, because, you know, really none of my extended family are followers of Jesus, and I would like to be a universalist. That would be fantastic.
Totally.
But I can't grapple with justice. Yeah. You know, there has to be some kind of divine justice to account for evil. So I appreciate that you took it to that extreme. And again, just as I'm listening to you, Chris, you know, the subtitle of your book is Getting Unstuck and Moving Forward with Passion and Purpose. And I think what our listeners have noticed is you guys you've just embodied that. That's what you do, whether it's organizational development and the absolute, like what's understated in this whole conversation is two people with no formal training building a highly sophisticated and highly effective and growing ministry or organization that does this work. Like that's just stunning. Like that, there should be somebody studying what you've done to learn what we can do. Because I know you guys kind of have a very Aussie, like, oh shucks, we just figured out what was next and no worries. But really incredible, incredible innovation to do what you did. So you've really modeled that for us. As much as Nick, I know you have expressed abject terror over the gauntlet of anxiety questions, I feel it's now time.
Friends, I think we have two types of beliefs. We have our precious belief. For example, my belief in Jesus is my most precious belief. But we also have these pesky, deep beliefs, and boy, are they deep-seated in us. And they very quickly can get in the way, whether they're conscious or subconscious, and they can block our experience with God. This fall, October 2nd through 4th, here in Colorado, but also live streaming, we are hosting the Unlocking Faith Conference, and it is uniquely designed to help you locate some of your deepest beliefs that you may know that you have or you may not know you have, and then give you a key to unlock those beliefs so that your precious belief in God, your experience with God, can flood deeper into your life. I'll be speaking. My wife, Lisa, will be speaking. We've got some others as well. Also, Dr. Chuck DeGroat will be one of our keynote speakers, one of my favorite thinkers and authors coming in to help us notice and name and locate and then unlock our deepest beliefs that are getting in the way of our enjoyment of God. Tickets are available now. You can join us in person in Colorado. You can join us live streaming either by yourself, or you can buy a pass for your whole congregation for those of you who have churches. You can also catch us on demand later. CapableLife.me is where you get tickets and more information.
So let's begin with this, I think a simple one. What is a type of situation or a type of personality that you know is going to generate anxiety in you? Christine, why don't you go first?
No, I'm just worried that Nick's going to say Christine's type of personality. That's what I was worried about. I'm going to say
Enneagram 1. Now, I'll go because that way Chris doesn't have all the good stuff. People who like to think about it but don't like to do it generate.
Of course,
they drive me crazy because they have 35 ideas about we could do this, we could do this, and yet they never get from neutral into gear to produce anything. So I'm not sure if it's anxiety or frustration, but that would be.
I don't hear any difference between those two words. Yeah. Okay, great. Yeah, so people who are hearers of the word but not doers, you might say, would be the ones that you want to have a little violent encounter with. Okay, Chris, how about you?
I have to admit that would be a big one. Obviously, look at the work that we do. We're very action-oriented. So, again, you know, sort of tweeting about it or posting about it and having high opinions about it and then doing nothing about it is like that certainly can get my blood boiling. That would be one form of anxiety. The other, I think, is people misunderstanding my intentions or motives can certainly trigger something on the inside of me, definitely. And I would say I could see how that would have some things to do with my attachment issue. It goes right back to my family and, you know, being adopted and growing up in the way that I did. So it's something I've had to work through, and especially to have the degree of visibility that I've got, the large kind of global organization that we have, there will always be somewhere someone is, and even someone within our own organization that misunderstands or misinterprets, or, you know, it has taken me a lot of growing to be able to live with that, because I can't possibly think that, you know, everyone say in Bulgaria or Mexico City or Thailand, you know, is going to at all times understand why we've made certain decisions about certain things. And that, and I think even in the culture in which we live, where, you know, everyone's very quick to voice opinions about lots of things, you're just kind of going, man, that I could cause the anxiety if I constantly need to be on the front foot and ahead of everything and making sure everybody in 19 offices knows every reason why we're doing everything. You can't live like that. I mean, eventually, you know, you're going to, so you just have to be okay with that. And I have this great friend that has this great podcast called Managing Leadership Anxiety, and he really helps me be able to navigate some of those things.
Yeah, I get what you're saying too, Christine. I'm wired the same way. Like, to me, I don't mind someone misunderstanding me, but when they misattribute my motives.
Right.
When I think, you know, no, I'm really trying to be helpful here. That just, boy, that sends me through the roof. Okay. The second, we've got four questions today. Three of them are gauntlet, one's relaxing. So the second question is, is there an area in your life where you keep running into yourself and you wish you could kind of not be this way? So in my life, for example, I find myself when somebody is venting to me, my brain tells me they want me to rescue them. And I'm having trouble stopping that. Like they actually don't want me to come in and save the day. They just need someone to listen. But my brain kind of tricks me and I keep running into that in my life. Would you have an attribute in your life where you're like, oh, there I am again doing that thing? What would that be?
Well, I'll do mine. You know what I do is I second and third guess myself. Maybe even fourth. Nick would probably say she 100 times second guesses herself, because it is, if I don't arrest that thing, it is my default. Even with all these years, 35 years of ministry, global organization, speaking like I do, I am still stunned at how often I second guess myself. You know, and I've got a bit of a track record where objectively I would think you don't need to, especially in certain areas, and yet I still do.
Good. Okay.
I would be like you, Steve, in that if you're telling me a problem, there is a solution to that problem. I'll give you the solution. We can implement the solution and we can move on and not have to talk about it again. And why it's like, Let's get on with it. While I'm sure I do the same thing on many things that I, but generally, if you're giving me a problem, I'm a problem solver, so I will give you an answer and let's get on and fix the problem and move on.
Yeah, yeah. And having raised two teenage young daughters, I'm sure that never got you into trouble, Nick.
Never.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, third question. As you consider your family upbringing, what is one asset from your family of origin and what's one liability? And again, I'll play. Our family were very adventurous. And what's interesting is we didn't do our kids' hobbies. Us kids were dragged along to my dad's hobbies, and I was bored out of my brain when I was like 6 or 7 years old at the motor racing track. And now my dad's hobbies are all my hobbies. So the sense of adventure, this sense of adventure is an asset, but a liability for me would be cusses don't ask for help. Cusses help others. So one of the things I'm working on is I don't pray for myself. I don't think I'm worth praying for example, at a real deep core, that would be a liability. Who would like to play this fabulous game? What's an asset and what's a liability from your family of origin?
I've never thought about it, not once.
You should. You got like 15 kids. You've got lots of them.
I'll say, Nick, that's a completely adequate answer. Like, in all seriousness, that's a fine answer to answer.
I'm going to give the same answer for both. My family's the asset is our liability. My Greek passion and my Greek passion, especially married to a man from an English-Irish heritage. Asset and liability.
Yeah,
very good.
I guess my asset would be just Steady Eddie. My mother was English, so stiff upper lip, stop, don't complain, just keep going. So I'd keep on marching on.
Yeah. We'll imply or infer that there may or may not be a liability connected to that.
Especially married to a Greek passionate woman, Steve. I'm just going, you just work that out.
So match made in heaven, yeah.
I mean, to 10 immediately, and I tried to get him off the one up to...
Well, okay, now you're in my field, because what's so fascinating is the teeter-totter seesaw of actually what, I'm being a bit bold here, guys, but what might calm Chris down is if Nick got more animated. Yes. And I right? So yeah, Nick's like, nope, not gonna.
Nope, I've tried that.
Oh, you tried it? Okay.
I think what he's trying to say is nothing will calm Chris down.
Yeah. All right, last question. When you can answer this one of two ways. Chris, you've answered this before for me. So here's two questions. You just choose the one you want. When in your life have you felt most fully and completely loved lately? That's one version of the question. The second version is very related. Where do you feel most home? Where or with whom do you feel like home? Like, I'm just me. I can relax. My leadership is off. I'm just me. So when in your life have you felt most fully loved lately, or where's home for you?
I would say our oldest daughter has just come back from studying abroad for a year. So to have both the girls at home is an absolute joy. They make me feel loved to have all three of the girls in one place. And it is very much at home, because there is so much, there's so much banter that is totally, you can't be serious with our girls. When the door's closed and everybody's home, then they will make fun of everybody and anybody, and they are absolutely hilarious. So it's entertaining and fun and lovely, and it is the greatest joy to have them in the house. So I think there's I know lots of people who can't wait for their kids to get out of the house. I am happiest when both my daughters are in the house and around, and I mope terribly when they're away. Mm-hmm. What about you, Mrs. Kane?
Yeah, I love that. I was thinking the same thing with Catherine. I felt two things. Really loved when she came back. She's done study abroad in London and just has glued herself to Nick and I. And, you know, we've got a couple of days. We've had a very big start of the year, and we've got a couple of days vacation coming up. And she's like, oh, I want to come with you guys. I can't even tell you. I thought, Jesus, if you're going to take me home right now, my 21-year-old daughter coming back from study abroad and wants to, of her own volition, not only wants to, like really proactively organized it. I thought, who wants at 21 to be with the parents? Like, you know, as first choice. So that for both, that was just such a huge win. And another strange way, it's because I'm so works oriented, I get that, but I opened her bedroom door yesterday. I mean, it's a bomb shelter. Let me just say whatever training, I feel sorry for any future husband, because listen, the kid does not know where the washing basket is. It's like her floor. But I just remember like opening the, I said, you know what, Catherine, so that we all keep loving each other, I'm just going to shut this door. I'm going to pretend that I never saw that. It's, you know, it's fine. You, I want her to keep coming home. So we've decided I'm never making any comment about that. But she's like, Mom, and I know this sounds ridiculous, but it's like, I know I've got it. I'm putting it all in piles because I just love it. And everyone's going to say, Christine, you have just been conned by your kid. But I love how it is when you bring it out. And I'm, in a sense, because of the way I'm wired up, the way that the fact that she loves how I wash fold, just because I'm going to put all the sweet smelly stuff in, I'm going to fold it in a certain way, I'm going to set her things up. And because acts of service is a huge love language for me, the fact that she wants me to do that and would put it on hold and it actually means something to her, in a warped way, all I think perhaps because our world is so huge, the normality of that actually is, I don't know, it warms my heart in a huge way.
It's so kind of her to allow Chris to thrive in her gift of washing and cleaning. I just think that, like, that's so selfless of her.
Selfless. What a model child.
She's an Aussie kid, mate. She's got me worked out.
Well, I listened to that and I think, well, who wouldn't want more time with Nick and Christine Kane? You guys are somehow at the same time absolutely everyday, approachable, unpretentious, and also utterly remarkable human beings, both as like what you can do individually, but watching the way you guys work together, minister together, having seen it behind closed doors myself, I'm just so grateful for you. Thank you for coming on the show. Chris's brand new book coming out in May, Don't Look Back. There'll be a link to it on the show notes for my listeners. Also a link to A21. It's going to be no great surprise that when you go to the A21 website, there are ways to actively be involved. You can give money. You can participate in marches. There's all kinds of things you can do with A21. And so Nick and Christine Kane, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks for having us.
A miracle. I can't think if I've been on any podcast ever with Nick. So you literally have performed a miracle greater than the resurrection of Jesus. This is, I'm going to promote this so much because I'm like, everyone, you want to know what the other half's like? This is it. So you've done a miracle.
Oh, what a pleasure. Thank you, guys.
We love you.
Thanks,
Thank you.
Steve.
Love you guys, too.
For more resources, visit stevecusswords.com or missyoualliance.org.